is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Julia Carpenter, filling in for Shimita Basu. Today, a parenting expert on how to make the U.S. a better place to raise kids. The United States is one of the wealthiest countries in the world. But when it comes to support for parents and families, we lag behind many of our peers. We're one of the only countries without a national paid parental leave policy. We have one of the highest infant and maternal mortality rates among peer nations, and we spend far less on early childhood care than other wealthy countries. Unsurprisingly, parents in the U.S. really feel this lack of support.
Where is my village? Is a question that comes up a lot. I was told there was a village. Where is it?
That's Emily Oster. She's an economist, parenting expert, best-selling author, and the CEO of Parent Data, a data-driven guide through pregnancy, parenthood, and beyond. She also hosts the podcast Parent Data with Emily Oster. Now, if you're a parent or preparing to become one, chances are you're already familiar with Emily's work. She has become so many people's go-to source for parenting guidance that is backed by evidence and delivered in an eye-level and pragmatic way. That's why, when I started thinking about ways we could make parents and families' lives better, I wanted to call up Emily to hear what big-picture solutions she'd want to see to address these issues in the U.S.
I think what's striking about the U.S. is not only the incredibly limited support that we provide parents, but also the inequality in that support. So one of the kind of key elements that I think we're missing in all of this discussion is lack of support for early childhood, lack of resources, lack of access to childcare. To the extent those are in some ways true for everybody, so there is no national parental leave for anyone, but many people in higher socioeconomic groups have access to that leave through their job. And so in addition to the overall low level of support, there is this just incredible inequity of support that we don't see elsewhere. So if you look at something as simple as infant mortality, to see that in the data, that's much higher in the U.S. than it is in a country like Sweden. And all of that difference is about lower socioeconomic groups in the U.S., poorer women having higher infant mortality than comparable groups in Sweden, whereas the kind of college-educated white women in both places have similar infant mortality rates. So it just is so much a story of inequality that I don't want that piece to be lost in the overall incredible sense that we are failing. And that even if you have tremendous amount of resources, it's still extremely hard.
It does seem that American society is still really built around this assumption that one parent, usually the mom, is going to stay at home. Even though we know that hasn't been the norm, it seems like we're almost stuck in this 1940s household model. Does that ring true to you? Does that ring true to your readers, you think?
There are pieces of that, for sure. It is challenging to have two people work a lot and also have a kid or many kids for some of the reasons that, you know, some of the childcare reasons and some pretty difficult to ignore reasons, like kids just take time. One of the things that's quite interesting, and I would sort of pull on Claudia Golden's work very much here, who's a Nobel Prize winning economist at Harvard, who's worked on a lot of these issues. She's sort of pointed out that a lot of jobs, particularly, sort of higher income jobs, are very greedy. The work is very greedy. It wants more and more hours from people. And as you move up, there's more and more hours of work. And it's difficult to have two people have these kind of greedy jobs at the same time. So when kids arrive, there's often a choice made where one person pulls back a little and one person leans forward a little. And those small changes initially can then translate to larger changes later. And it tends to be in the direction that women do more household work and men do more labor market work. There's nothing inherently wrong with that, except if that isn't where you want it to end up. And I will say one other thing, which is when I talk to people about how to think about this, because so much of this framing is around, you know, do I want to be a stay-at-home mom or a stay-at-work mom, as my friend's kid called her
work
once.
Stay-at-work mom. Oh, my
yeah.
God.
He said, what's great about that story is that he said, well, you know, this other kid at school, you know, she has said a stay-at-home mom, but I told her I have a stay-at-work mom, which is sort of like, nah, I guess. But what I tell people is that that dichotomy, I think, is a really unhelpful way to think about this. And instead, I would ask, like, what is the optimal allocation of adult work hours in the household, which is much longer, but gets at the idea that you don't have to choose one person's at home and one person's at work. You can choose both people, lean back a little, but maybe not as much, or we lean in at different times, that there's a lot of ways to structure that. And by opening the conversation, we might get to a place that we're happier with than if we keep the conversation to there's only one way to do this. It's either A or B, and there's nothing in between.
I definitely want to come back to work, and I think some of our questions later will lead us there. But before we get into some of your changes, some of your proposed changes, I want to ask what I think is a typical critique when we talk about parenting and when we talk about reform and we talk about things that could help or aid in this. That's the price tag. That's how would we pay for all this stuff, or who is going to pay for all this stuff? And I was wondering, when you think about policy and policy reform, what's the cost-benefit analysis you're doing?
That's a hard question. And I think it's, you know, it's a hard question because it is, like, economics is all about constrained optimization, right? And so recognizing that if you do one policy, you can't do another policy. And we think about what policies to do, we do want to be trading off values and thinking about the opportunity cost of what else would we spend money on. I mean, I think some of the way I come into this is, like, what can be more important than children? And, you know, that, of course, many things could be more important. I think that's a little bit of an extreme view, but I think there's an awful lot of things that we spend money on where probably the benefits are lower than the kinds of returns we would get if we were making smart investments in families. My bigger, I think, critique of some of this is that we are not talking about how we choose the best policies. We're just talking about, like, let's dump money in a money pit. And some policies that we do are money in a money toilet. And some policies we do are more effective. And we could maybe spend a little more time trying to figure out, of the kinds of early childhood interventions we do, what are the ones that are going to have impacts on, say, incarceration rates or juvenile detention rates or high school graduation rates. In the long run, you have a few fewer kids in jail and graduating from high school. That's a lot of tax dollars saved, and it may actually be worth it. So more than the question of, you know, how can we find this money, my answer would be, let's make sure that we're spending the money well. And if you think about that, there may actually be places where there's money on the money trees and we're not picking it.
We're now going to talk about the ways you'd like to see the U.S. better support parents. And one of your proposed changes is 12 weeks of paid leave for all birthing persons. So this would mean anyone who has a newborn gets 3 months of paid time off. I think this change is at the very top of a lot of people's lists. It's, for many people, the first thing that comes to mind when they think, how can we improve the lives of parents and the lives of families? Can you talk about why this is such an important reform?
Yeah. The evidence is just incredibly strong in terms of benefits for babies and benefits for parents. So we see evidence from rollouts of either unpaid or paid leave in a variety of places that show improvements in infant health, improvements in maternal functioning, reductions in mental health issues, many cases improvements in infant mortality. So just many, many, many positive changes that result from having paid leave. And it is hard to argue with those data. They're really, really clear. It's also the case that every other country in the world has a form of paid leave. I'm actually not totally sure if Papua New Guinea is still holding out on this, but that was for a long time the only other place. But that feels, you know, not ideal. And I think the other thing that people pull on here is, like, it just seems fundamentally unethical that a reasonable share of women in the U.S. go back to work 2 weeks after having a baby. Like, when you describe the physical experience of having a baby, whatever way you give birth, vaginal birth, C-section, this is a physically traumatic event. People are not equipped to go back to work after 2 weeks. Maybe some people are, but for most people, or for a large share of people, this is just, it's just not okay. And so I think the combination of that kind of, like, ethical feeling and the incredibly strong data is why this is the top of many people's agendas. And, you know, why 12 weeks rather than 6 weeks? I think 6 weeks is too little. I'd love to go to 16 weeks. I think 12 weeks seems like a politically feasible space.
What have all these other countries been able to figure out that we just can't get to?
You know, I think that this is related to the general sense of sort of social, like every pot on its own bottom kind of individualization of that we have in America in general. And I think it's gotten stuck many times in the U.S., sometimes because of its popularity. I think it's like such a popular thing that it's something you want to stick in when the other side doesn't like other parts of your bill, you know? You want to like attach it to something that other people don't like to
strategic.
To sweet it up.
Yeah.
It's strategic. You know, my sense is, I always have the sense that if we just had like, you know, if we sort of kept this more limited to itself, you could get stronger bipartisan support because it is an effort that you see a lot of bipartisan support for.
Yeah. Yeah. Earlier this year, a House bipartisan group put forward a pretty modest framework to increase access to paid family leave. It's admittedly pretty thin. 14 states and DC have implemented some type of paid leave program. So that's some progress. I wonder where else you see progress, where else you've seen some big steps.
I think there have been large steps in private employers in this. And I think that's important. I mean, I think, you know, a decade ago, we would not have seen the same kinds of 16 weeks of leave in private employers. That's gone up a lot. They've extended it to men in many cases. I think people are taking that leave more. Men are taking it more. So I think there has been quite a lot of progress in the private sector over the past, you know, 20 years. I mean, you know, my mom was a professor, and when she had me in 1980, she tried to time the birth for Christmas break. Because she was teaching, but she did not hit it. It's not as easy as you would think. She got February and she took a week and a half off and then was back in the classroom because there was no, Yale University, bastion of, you know, professionalism, did not have any maternity leave at the time. Now they do. And so there are definitely changes in private employers that I think have moved in a good direction. You know, getting this access for everyone is going to require legislation either at the state or the federal level.
Yeah. Yeah. Moving on to your second idea. Your second idea is free doulas for all birthing persons.
Yeah.
And first, what does a doula do? What are the benefits? And for someone who's never heard the word, paint a bit of a picture as to what this is.
A doula is a birth support person. And what a doula does is they are there during the birth. They're not a medical provider. It's not a midwife or an obstetrician. It's someone who is there in a supportive role to do a variety of different things, you know, massage, counseling. There are many things that they do. And it turns out that in the data, randomizing someone into having this kind of support person has many positive impacts. So it reduces the C-section rate, it tends to increase Apgar scores, it improves mom's satisfaction with birth, actually reduces the epidural use rate. So it's a bunch of things like that. And those come from randomized trials where people are allocated doulas at the hospital. And it turns out that actually you get a lot of those benefits even if people have one of their friends trained as a doula. So find your friend. We'll have your friend go to a few classes to explain a little bit what this is. And it turns out you get a bunch of benefits from that. So this is just a widely supported birth intervention. And I think we should have everybody have them.
On a recent episode of your podcast, you also talked about having a doula just makes people's birth experiences better.
Yeah.
People say they're happier.
They like it better.
Yeah. That struck me. I thought, oh my gosh, people are just saying they're happy. That's something we have to take into consideration.
Yeah, we do. It's hard to sell that. So in that podcast, I was talking to a state legislator about her efforts to get this paid for by Medicaid in New York, which she did. Senator Sumra Brooke, who's amazing. But if you say, you know, this is going to save you money, people are sitting up and listening. If you say, you know, this makes people happier, that's not does not get as many points in the legislative discussion, but I think it really should. And maybe not in that discussion, but I think in our considerations of what we value and what we are trying to deliver to people, so often in women's health, the idea that something would improve your quality of life, improve your experience of the world, that like that's like, ah, that's like a nice to have. But actually, that's really very important.
Hmm. And actually, even setting aside how it makes people feel, data shows that providing people with doulas leads to reduced overall costs for births. Can you tell me more about that connection there?
Yeah. So if you have that is basically coming through the C-section reduction. So if you have a C-section, that's much more expensive for a payer. It's more days in the hospital. It's just surgery costs more. And so if you reduce that, you can have a relatively small reduction, and that actually pays for quite a lot of doula time.
And we already know that 12 states and Washington, D.C. have implemented Medicaid coverage for this.
Yeah.
And I think 9 other states are in the process of implementation. But I'm wondering, do you think that this is the best way, this state-by-state implementation process? Or is there some other national policy, some other grander scale way that can get free doulas to all birthing persons?
Generally, the way we would get this to the people who need it most is with Medicaid as the payer. So Medicaid's a payer for about half of births in the U.S., and it's the payer for a large share of women with fewer resources. So getting Medicaid to pay for this is kind of the key to that sort of that population. And that would have to happen at the state level, because generally the way that Medicaid works is through these block grants to states. And so they decide how to use it. And so that has to happen at the state level. There are things that could happen always at the federal level around, you know, how do we encourage things or additional money? But like that particular approach, I think, is a kind of state by state. It's probably best done state by state. There's another challenge, which is actually getting people who are equipped to do this. So training doulas and training doulas in places where this hasn't traditionally been, you know, a kind of available service, and training doulas who are connected to the populations that they're going to serve. And so that feels like a sort of additional challenge, where it is perhaps the case that federal money could help, because that's like a separate from being the payer. There's just the creating the supply. If you actually want everybody to have this, you need people doing this job.
Well, we also have to mention that doulas are often not covered by private insurance.
Right.
So if you're not on Medicaid, what are your options?
My guess is if Medicaid starts covering this reliably, then private insurers will be pushed to do it. I suspect, you know, Blue Cross and Kaiser are going to have a hard time not doing things like this when they're covered by Medicaid.
Next, we have home nurse visits in the first week of life. Why did this make your list?
So this is another place where I think we differ quite a lot from many of our peer countries, not as many of them as with paid leave. But in many places in Europe, there's a fair amount of social support from the medical care system at home after you have your baby. And so part of the reason I sort of pull on this is some of the work I did a few years ago, where you're looking at patterns of infant mortality in the U.S. and elsewhere. And what we saw is that the U.S. infant mortality, that's deaths in the first year, is elevated relative to most of our peer countries. A lot of that elevation is in the period after people are home. So actually, we do pretty well in the hospital in terms of the supports that we have. But once people are home in this period from, you know, 2 weeks to a year, that's where the U.S. mortality is way higher than elsewhere. It's hard to know exactly why that is, but one thing that's very clear in the world is that we are not supporting people when they go home. And if you are giving birth in England or one of the Scandinavian countries, a nurse comes to your house after a few days after that. They check in, they see how you're doing. There has been some success of programs like this. There's a program called the Nurse Family Partnership that has done this fairly successfully in the U.S. in terms of providing supports. Some of those programs are very large. They're like a very comprehensive set of supports. That's probably not what every family needs. I think it would be interesting to explore smaller scale versions of this that would try to just provide some of the support many people need when they get home. You know, they send you home with your baby. There's no instructions. Like having someone come and just say, like, do you have the stuff you need? You know, are there social services we can connect you to? Are you depressed? Like having someone there, I would like to see us at a minimum experiment with those kind of programs to see if they worked. Sort of getting back to this question of how can you spend money on stuff? How do you trade it off? That's an example of something where I think if we could understand if it worked and what kind of outcomes you'd see, there would be a real case for broader usage.
You totally anticipated my next question. You mentioned experimentation. I immediately thought, okay, she said 1 week. Why 1 week? What's special about 1 week? Why not home visits for the first month or the first 6 months of life? What's your thinking around that?
Yeah, I want at least one, you know.
Yeah.
I want one. You know, yes, I think if I were really to design an experiment with this, I think you'd try different versions of this and probably different versions that sort of thought carefully about costing. So if I had to design an experiment on the fly on this podcast recording.
Do it. I'm curious.
So I think there's a lot of value to having someone come once. Because there's a lot of things I think you would learn triage-wise coming once. Yeah, how much support does this person have? Do they seem to have the resources? Is there a place for the baby to sleep? Do they have a car seat? Do they need to be connected to, you know, WIC or SNAP or one of the other social programs that could help? So feels like there's a lot of triage you could do in one visit. And then you could think about, you know, does this person need me to come back? And sometimes you go to someone and everything is fine and their mom's there and, you know, their mother-in-law is also there and everything seems to be going well and maybe you're not needed. And sometimes I think you'd find, okay, we need to do more. So there's a sense in which you might be able to get to the most cost-effective program by using a kind of triage system where some people get one visit and some people get multiple visits.
I'm also thinking about parents who would hear this and get scared. You know, could home visits make some families more vulnerable to child protective services or intervention by agencies or any of these privacy concerns that people have?
Yeah. And I think that when this has been run in, you know, so Rhode Island has done some of this. They have some Medicaid-funded home visits. You know, it's a choice. So you can absolutely have to tell people if you don't want this, you know, you don't need it. But part of having it in a more routine way where this is something everybody gets is I think it helps with a lot of those concerns. You know, when this happens in these European countries, it's not somebody's checking up on you, it's everybody gets this. Everybody gets the nurse. The nurse comes for everybody.
Yeah.
Just that's it. They're not coming for you. They come for everybody. It's a thing that happens and there's a frame there that's positive and not like I'm coming because you need help or I'm coming to check up on you or find out what you're doing.
Or to catch you.
Yeah.
Or to catch. It's normalized.
Yeah, exactly.
So your fourth and final reform is reliable summer care options for all. And I'm sure this is another huge one for so many parents. Can you say more about this change, more about why you're suggesting it and how it would impact parents and families?
Yeah, so the public school system, for all of the things that we complain about, really serves many important purposes. We see that all the time in, you know, all of the incredible work that teachers and school administrators do to serve our kids. I think we saw a piece of it so strongly during the pandemic, just how much kids lost by not being at school and how much that was both the learning, but even putting that aside, how important school is for the fabric of society's functioning, that, you know, this is where your kid goes during the day and you know that they'll be safe and you know that they'll be fed. You know, school lunches are for many kids the most nutritionally balanced meal that they have. You know, they've really worked on those guidelines and there's fruits and vegetables and it's a safe place. But it happens from 7:30 in the morning until 3:00 in the afternoon, you know, for 9 months of the year. And families need more childcare than that. And they need more aftercare than that often. And that's something some school districts have built in. And then there's this period in the summer when families who have been relying on schools for school lunches and have been relying in schools for all of this childcare are kind of abandoned. And then even for people who have a lot of resources, it's actually still really hard to figure out what to do with your kid for the summer. So just thinking as a society about like, how are we scaffolding that? And I think there's a lot of ways we can do that. You know, more school services in the summer for people, you know, not year-round school, but ways that we can use school buildings or school resources, school infrastructure to serve summer activities. Other ways we can help parents connect to this feels important so we don't have people just scrambling and paying tremendous amounts of money for, you know, summer camps that don't actually meet for very many hours anyway.
So in an ideal world, how would this work? Would it go through schools? Would it be subsidies to families for existing programs? The U.S. creates a program that offers this to all families.
I think the place I would start is to go through schools.
Yeah.
Because not through schools like schools have to run all the time, but through schools in the sense of using the school infrastructure as a way to serve kids, in part because, you know, that is already the routine that families are in. We already know we have that space. It's often unused in the summer. So it feels like there are some synergies there.
This also begs the question, why not restructure the whole public school calendar?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you're going to get that done. I'm trying to focus on things I think could happen. So, as I tell my kids all the time, year-round school sounds great to me, and I would sign up for it in a hot second, but I don't think we're getting that.
I wanted to ask you about that. Tell me more. I heard you say that on an episode of your podcast a handful of years ago. Are you still a fan of it, and why?
I mean, so yeah, I mostly tell my kids that as a joke, but I think there are some interesting things that one would want to explore with that. You know, I do think that there's some value to a longer break for kids. And so literally year-round school with no breaks probably has downsides. Exactly how good that would be for learning, I'm not sure. There are some good reasons that having less of like one long break could serve groups differently. So for example, we know that there's a fair amount of what people call summer melt in learning, and that summer melt is larger for some groups than others. And so if we sort of think about that as contributing to some share of the inequality in academic outcomes, a school calendar that had less of this like giant break in the middle could serve like less resource kids in differentially better. So there's like some interesting reasons to experiment with that. Part of why I would not put that on a policy list is I think it's impossible.
And when we think about models the U.S. could look to, is there one country or one system, one place that you think has just really gotten it right when it comes to parents and families and supporting them?
I mean, I think people always point to the Scandinavian countries. You know, they point to Sweden and they're like, it's so, you know, it's a magical paradise. And it does seem very nice there for people with kids. I think that those models are hard because we're so far from them in terms of the diversity and demographics and like a complicated political and other landscape of the U.S. The U.S. is so large. There are so many ways that we're organized differently than these other places that to sort of say, like, wouldn't it be better if we were like Sweden? It feels very empty. That feels very empty to me.
Yeah. What direction do you point people when you're looking for examples of a system that's working?
I think I'd like to point to smaller pieces that are working in individual states and even at a very small scale. So the Times had a very interesting article the other day.
I read it. The Brooklyn School.
The Brooklyn School. Exactly. About a Brooklyn charter school that's like going all day, like basically from 7 a.m. till 7 p.m. and offering good aftercare. That's an interesting model. Is it accessible for everybody? Probably not. Is it an interesting thing to think about? Yeah. So I think there's even on something like school lunches, which we didn't talk about, something else that I think about sometimes, you know, how can we do even better on the nutrition we're providing for kids? There are like school districts who are doing interesting stuff with local farmers or interesting stuff with, you know, food court. And like, there's all kinds of interesting models. And we're sometimes thinking of the diversity of experiences across school districts as something that we need to like limit. But I think it's something we can learn from.
Emily, thank you so much for joining me today and sharing these ideas with our listeners.
Thank you, guys.
You can listen to Parent Data with Emily Oster on Apple Podcasts. We'll include a link to it on our show notes page.